is too much light. I want to thank Dr. Williams for giving me the opportunity to be here, and good to be back and see so many friends I haven't seen for quite a while. So what I'd like to do over the next 30 minutes or so, simply talk about what do consumers expect, and as an industry, how you can go about meeting those consumer expectations. But I'll also provide you a lot of background information on the subject. Notwithstanding recent economic problems, up to then there was a tremendous increase in GDP worldwide. Quite a few people are moving from lower income to middle income and upper middle income, et cetera. And there was associated with that, there's an increase for protein and specifically beef, as I'll show you. Past NCBA president in 2008 indicated over 1 billion people in 2007 moved to middle class. Now, what's the significance of that for the beef industry is that with affluence, there's an increase, and they tend to switch from consuming poultry and other proteins to beef. With affluence also, there's an increase, a switch from ground beef and et cetera to more steaks and roasts. But also with that, his expectation goes up. So in order to maintain the beef demand for these new people moved in new income bracket, it moves the industry to meet those the expectation of that class of folks. Now, what are the expectations? The expectation is very simple. When they pay a lot of money for steaks, they expect to have a satisfying eating experience. Just came back from Washington, D.C. This gentleman was telling me the night before they went to a steakhouse, he paid $220 for a steak. when you pay that kind of money, you want to have a satisfying eating experience. That eating experience is the interaction between juiciness, tenderness, and flavor. If you're going to a restaurant at home, you like to have as much information as you can provide the consumers to have a satisfying experience would be good for the industry. Ease of preparation, how to prepare it, etc. Now, in order to ensure consumer satisfaction, we asked this question a number of years ago, which one of these traits should be the focus of our research? And let me tell you, we selected to focus on tenderness, and let me tell you why. This slide includes close to 2,000 observations from Germplasm Evaluation Project at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. We looked at the variation we see sensory panel score for tenderness, juiciness, and flavor. You'll see that there's a tremendous amount of variation in tenderness, but not as much variation in juiciness and flavor. We looked at a number of steaks from a number of commercial plants, standard deviation sensory panel rating. Again, you will see there's 2 to 3 times or 4 times more variation in tenderness as there are in juiciness and flavor. You can look at it within muscles. There's some 11 muscles on this slide. The only muscle that's not true is tenderloin, but you can hardly find any variation in tenderloin. But in every other muscle, there's 3 to 5 times more variation in tenderness as there are in juiciness and flavor. So as we have done, and many of our colleagues have done, when you do a lot of consumer survey, they always ask them what's important. They tell you the number most important trait for them is tenderness, and they have repeatedly shown by the studies conducted by a number of folks that they're willing to pay a premium for a product if it can guarantee to be tender. But consumers have always paid a premium for tenderness. Go to a retail case anytime, and you'll see essentially we pay for tenderness. The most expensive cut is tenderloin, followed by rib and strip loin, and et cetera. So we have always traded based on tenderness, and that's true regardless of quality grade. So we decided to focus on tenderness. This is not to say juiciness and flavors are not important. In fact, they are very important. They are very critical. But it says there's the way we produce beef in this country, there's no inherent variation in juiciness and flavor. Any variation we see in juiciness and flavor, as I found in mine, and at Chris Ruth of all places the night before last, is done at the preparation level. If they overcook the meat, it'll be less juicy, and et cetera. So that is education activities, but not a researchable activity. Now, we are at BIF. I thought I should talk about a little bit about the fact of breeds on tenderness. There's just as much variation within breed as there are between breeds for tenderness. And that's not true for other two traits, consistent with what we've been talking about in terms of juiciness and flavor, and as opposed to a trait like retail product yield, which clearly there's breed effect, but there's no breed effect on eating quality. Now, breeds begin to show their differences when we draw a line, say, above certain level of tenderness or shear force. It's not acceptable. If you look at it, remarkably, the range we see in the shear force value is identical in all the breeds. But when we draw the line, we say anything greater than 5 kilograms is not acceptable. Now breeds begin to show their differences. Okay? Now, to meet the consumer expectation, many believe that we have to develop technology, processes, whatever it takes to control or manage the variation we see in meat tenderness. If we've done that, we've managed the variation, all the eating quality traits. To do that, we must understand the biological mechanism for meat tenderness project we began a number of years ago at Clay Center. First of all, let me give you, by the way, a background, an education opportunity for just in case there is one person in the room that doesn't know some of this terminology. Measure meat tenderness with two methods called Warner-Blasser shear force and slice shear force. Shear force is essentially an objective measure of meat tenderness. For Warner-Blasser shear force, you cook the steak to medium degree of doneness. You remove 6 half-inch core from the steak. You use a dull blade to measure the amount of force that it takes to shear through that core of meat. The higher the shear, the tougher the meat would be. This process, it's cumbersome to do. It's technically challenging. A lot of people believe, particularly grad students, if I can cook the steak, I can do Warner-Blasser shear force. We've conducted studies. A number of institutions found out the repeatability to be far below acceptable. For that reason, another reason, at Clay Center, we develop a new technology, which we call it slice shear force value. For the two reasons that I mentioned, it's Warner-Blasser shear force is laborious and requires certain degree of skills, and it's not conducive to high throughput operation. We develop a system that's just as accurate in the hands of untrained folks. It's more accurate. We call it slice shear force value. Essentially, we cook the steak in less than 7 minutes to medium degree of doneness. Instead of core, we remove one slice from the steak, modify the blades that we can measure the amount of shear required to shear that slice, and we call it slice shear force value. It's just as repeatable and accurate as Warner-Blasser shear force when you could look at the relationship between the measurements and sensory panel, and I argue that in the hands of untrained people, slice shear force will be far more accurate than Warner-Blasser shear force. Now, this is shear force, objective measure. As we mentioned, tenderness, juiciness are also important. We need to measure those. We don't have an objective measure, to objective instrument to make those measurements. For that, we use sensory panel. We grab folks, volunteers, or we screen them to see if they have the capability to be a judge. And if they do, they pass that initial screening. We train them and train them and train them till they become essentially like an instrument. And they'll tell you to judge you for tenderness, juiciness, and flavor. That information is often misused to say this is desirable, acceptable, etc. To be able to have that sort of data, you have to conduct consumer panels. That's when you talk about whether it's acceptable, not acceptable, etc. Now, what are the source of variation in meat tenderness? If you have not, many have, I have. If you sit around in a restaurant, two of you eating the same strip steaks, one of us has a real good eating experience, the other one has a terrible eating experience. A number of years ago, we asked the question, what's the basis for this? We hypothesized that those differences existed when the cattle came to slaughter plant, or those differences were created during the conversion of live animal into carcass, or it was a combination of both. To answer that question, we conducted study. We measured shear force value immediately after slaughter throughout postmortem storage. We found that right after slaughter, the meat has intermediate shear force value, probably be acceptable. But soon after slaughter, there's a dramatic rise in the shear force value, and we call that the toughness phase. We also did a lot of other measurements. Accompanied with rise in shear force value, there was a decline in the sarcomere length, and I'll tell you what sarcomere length is graphically in a moment. This is an illustration of the muscle. Essentially, you start with muscle, go to muscle bundles, and then you ultimately to myofibril. And this is a sarcomere length, which is essentially the functional unit of muscle. Contraction and relaxation at this level produces force, which is essentially the function of the muscle. So what we saw as associated with the development of rigor mortis, there was a shortening of the muscle. The length of the sarcomere in the resting muscle is about 2.2 to 2.4 micron. As a result of aging, it was shortened to about 1.6, 1.7 micron. Because we saw shortening in the sarcomere length, we hypothesized that that is responsible for the toughening. We tested that hypothesis experimentally. We prevented muscle from shortening, and sure enough, we did not see that rise in shear force value. If we could do that on a commercial scale, there would be no need for postmortem storage, et cetera, but unfortunately, that's commercially not feasible to do. So we now know the sources for that. Right after increase in toughness, which is induced by sarcomere shortening, an opposite process takes place, which is called tenderization phase. The function tenderization phase, if you will, is nothing but to overcome the toughness that was induced during the development of rigor mortis. And like the toughness phase, which we have seen repeatedly, occurs equally in our carcasses, tenderization phase does not occur equally. There's tremendous amount of variation between various individual cattle or sheep that they to go through postmortem storage. Some have the ability to overcome all of that and then some, and some do not have that capability at all. And it is this variation in ability to undergo postmortem storage or aging that is responsible for what we see on the, at the consumer level. Now, we then began a series of work trying to find out what's the biology of this, and I'll just briefly review that. This would be before aging. We can call it a tough piece of meat. This is a myofibrous piece of muscle magnified about 1,000 times. You see the structure is highly maintained, but as a result of aging or tenderization or meat that's tender, it's highly fragmented. If you look at the microscope electron microscope level, you'll see the tough one. This actually happened to be from a Calipese lamb. It's structured very well maintained after 21 days of aging. But in tender one, which is a controlled one, the structure is greatly damaged. And toughness is nothing but resistance to chewing. So the muscle that offers the least resistance would be the most tender one, and the muscle obviously that has this sort of structure will offer far less resistance and therefore will be more tender. Now the basis for that is a number of proteins, the so-called involvement in scaffolding of the muscle. These proteins are responsible for maintaining the integrity of the muscle, and some of them are degraded. How much they degraded, it's the basis for variation we see in meat tenderness, and to the extent to which these proteins are degraded will determine the amount of postmortem proteolysis or tenderization. And we also did many years' worth of work identifying an enzyme system, which is called the calpain system, which is responsible for this protein breakdown. And we also discovered that it's not the enzyme, actually, that's the variable, rather than its inhibitor, which is called calpastatin. And calpastatin essentially regulates postmortem proteolysis. Now, in addition, there are three factors that can explain all of the variation we see in the meat tenderness of all the muscle. One of them is sarcomere length, which we'll describe already. The second one is proteolysis, which we described already. And the third one is the connective tissue. These three, the combination of these three, will explain all the variation we see in all the muscle in a given carcass. It's a project we conducted a number of years ago. Look at the variation in these traits. There are some 11, 12 muscle. You see variation in collagen, in cooked muscle. Tremendous amount of variation. Muscles that tend to be involved in locomotion tend to have more connective tissue as opposed to support muscle, which they have less connective tissue. A tremendous amount of variation in sarcomere length, tenderloin, that's why tenderloin is tender. The way we hang the carcasses, muscle is actually stretched. And from 2.2 actually goes to 2.9 or 3.0 micron, and that's essentially why tenderloin or flat iron is tender. And then the last one is proteolysis, which the strip and loin tend to be the most susceptible to proteolysis, and hardly any proteolysis occurs in the most tender muscle in the carcass, which is called a tenderloin. Now, two different muscles can arrive at the same level of eating experience or sensory panel score through entirely different mechanisms. Look at two different muscles. One of them will be ribeye. Sensory panel rating was 5.9 for tenderness. And the other one is flat iron. Sensory panel rating was 5.9. Flat iron is tender because of sarcomere length. And ribeye is tender because of postmortem proteolysis. That information can be used and actually has been used by folks involved in further processing to enhance, to use different techniques to enhance meat tenderness. Now, a number of years ago, again, we began a project. We believe that to ensure meat tenderness, because there's a tremendous amount of variation, we need to have technology to predict meat tenderness. Began a project to develop a tenderness-based meat classification, essentially tools that would allow a processor or a retailer to offer guaranteed tender beef. We looked at a whole host of stuff, and we saw there was a real good relationship between meat tenderness 1 to 2 days postmortem and 14 and after aging. So we began an effort to develop a methodology that we can measure meat tenderness very rapidly and 1 to 2 days postmortem, and use that information to predict how tender will be 14 days later. A bunch of young and naive scientists thought if we could come up with a method that it takes less time to do quality grading and is far more accurate, it will be used. But obviously, we were proven wrong. We removed the steak less than 10 minutes. We cooked the steak to, again, medium degree of doneness. We measure slash shear force value, and this is the relationship. We can certify a proportion dose to be guaranteed to be tender. That program, actually, Safeway came to me in 2000, 2001, and asked me to put a program together for them, which we did, and Safeway went to a processor, which we're now allowed to talk about. It went to Cargill, and if you go to Safeway, you have a chance to go to Safeway. They have a guaranteed tender program, and I understand that's an extremely successful program for Safeway and Cargill. Supposedly close to $1 billion account for Cargill. We offered the same program to everyone, but there were no takers. Everyone said it's too expensive, you have to cut it, etc. But it's used successfully between a retailer and a packer. But again, we made the information available to all the packers. They said, come up with something that's non-invasive. So they began the work to develop something that's non-invasive. In fact, they told us exactly what it needs to be. Needs to be accurate. Needs to be conducted less than 10 seconds because it has to be online, durable to withstand plant environment, reasonably priced, non-invasive, and you have to be able to measure the time that you grade the carcasses. It has to reflect tenderness after postmortem aging. We started working on the near-infrared, using near-infrared technology to predict meat tenderness, essentially bought the infrared equipment, and went to Lexington plant and screened literally close to 1,000 carcasses, and we came up with these spectras. And then we looked for useful, and obviously we measured meat tenderness. We looked for useful spectras, and we developed an algorithm that we can use this information to predict meat tenderness almost instantaneously. Well, we don't predict meat tenderness, we certify a proportion of the carcasses to be tender. And this is the information from some 576 from four different plants. These are the ones that we certified to be tender. Of the 576, we could certify 506 of them to be tender. Of those that we certified, 3%, there was 3% error. 3% were not certified. Robert, that's the reason why we can't call toughness, because 70 of those, we don't say that, but if you were going to say, almost everyone wants to say, well, identify which one tough. Well, you can't do that because error associated with that is very high. If we were going to do that, we would say 70 of them are tough, but actually there were 20% of those were not tough. So that's why it's easier to predict which one will be. You can certify and say nothing. Those would be, as you sell those as commodity. Anyway, we made this technology available to a company in Colorado. We gave them free work with them, came up with the technology, and I now understand that everyone complains that it's too expensive. So since going to Seattle, I was lucky to have a great physicist from Johns Hopkins. With his background in physics and optics, and with my background in meat tenderness, we began a project to develop something like that that is at a fraction of the cost. We've actually just finished the development of the technology. We call it Tenderscope TM. We have just finished the development. We know it's good, repeatable, etc. And have just come up to agreement with the packing company We're going to hire a summer student. We're going to get our instrument, go from plant to plant, and collect a lot of data for us to write the algorithm to predict mean temperatures. Hopefully, we'll have done by the end of summer. We'll know if it's accurate. We hope it will be, and I'm pretty sure it will be, but we don't know until then. But again, the instrument will be far more flexible and a fraction of the cost of the one that we gave to a company in Colorado. Now, in order to meet the consumer expectation short-term, to use correct genetics, no more than 25% unscreened. What I mean by unscreened, if all the genomic information, 50K chip, 200K chip, obviously we'll have, hopefully we'll have information that we can use those to screen cattle. Do not use implant with negative effect on meat tenderness, and we know we know quite a bit about implants. And again, avoid aggressive implant technologies. Proper days feeding, minimum of 90 days should achieve the goal. Proper handling during shipping to minimize stress. Use high to extend as possible high voltage electrostimulation or high frequency electrostimulation. There's nothing more important, absolutely nothing is more important than 14 days of aging. And I'll show you some data to convince you of that. Could use the invasive system or the non-invasive system we came up with to guarantee meat tenderness. And again, at the consumer level, HEV does a better job than anyone that I know of, provides a lot of information, and that's why they sell more beef than anybody else, I believe. Today's still true, because they provide a lot of information to the consumers. This is the information on effective postmortem aging. Let me orient you with this slide. These are some breeds that we looked at. You can look at any breed. I bet you will get the same sort of observation. This is the Warner Blast of Shear Force. The dot is the mean for 7 days, mean for 14 days, and the range of shear force value observed in each of those. Even Angus, you look at Angus, if you don't age it properly, 22% of them will not be accepted. A breed like Brahman that gets negative effect, but at 7 days, 63% of them will not be acceptable. But if you look what happened, if you go to 14 days. Actually, breeds that don't have as good a reputation will benefit greatly from extended postmortem aging and use of tenderness program because it'll allow you to identify 60, 70, 80%. They're perfectly fine. Long-term, as what we just talked about, and hopefully use the non-invasive technology that we just talked about, and hopefully the information from all this investment in genomics will bear fruit to use those as a screening tool. Genetics accounts for is a significant determinant of meat tenderness. There are all kinds of estimates for heritability. I like to use Dr. Cook's data from 1980 at Clay Center. I think that has the most observations. Probably, to me, is the most reliable one. So about heritability is about 0.3. And if the results of tenderness are shared, you know, with the seed stock producers, we will be able to improve the national herd for tenderness. None of that stuff is happening now, but hopefully we will be able to do that sort of stuff in the future. I'd like to take this opportunity, just in case if I didn't get a chance anymore, sort of review the history a little bit. There are many people in this room that remember where we were, and I just want to review where the industry was prior to 1997 and what we did to change it, and so to remind you of those lessons and beg with you not to forget those lessons. And this is a number of slides from Wayne Purcell. And these were the early, mid-90s, and there are a number of meetings we were attending, trying to see what we can do to change the beef demand. A quote from Wayne, it says, "What's happening in substitutes like pork and chicken can change beef demand, but it is not cheap pork and chicken that is blamed for prolonged problem in beef. There has to be something else." It says, "Consumers voting with their dollars told the beef industry that they did not like the fresh beef offering. If what you are offering is allowed to diverge from what a changing consumer wants, you will be in trouble. You can expect price decline, and something needs to be done before the market share is lost." Now, clearly it's not price. This is the information for beef price from 1990 to 1997, and for inflation adjusted, there was actually a 20% decline in beef price, and the demand was declining. Okay? Then what was the reason for that? The reason for that were the following. We had unacceptable frequency of tough beef. People like Gary Smith were using the numbers, 1 out of 4 times you get a bad eating experience. The product was not consumer friendly, et cetera, et cetera. And late, a few years after that, we developed a food safety problem with E. coli 15787. This is the information that I got from NCBA a number of years ago that shows the expenditure on beef. Actually, I have the data. I just got it from 2007, 2008. I believe it's about close to $75 billion. So there was a tremendous decline in beef until about 1997, 1998. That's where we began to change. Look at the dramatic, and it's still going up in 2000 and 2007 and 2008. Now, what was done? Industry finally gave consumer what they wanted. A product that was safe, it was tender, consistent quality, and they gave them a lot of information, even in the package you got today. Just look, see how much information you had about how to prepare beef offering, et cetera. And go back 15 years ago, none of that stuff would have been in the BIF package. Now, how was it done? Industry set goal for example, 20% improvement in 10 years in beef tenderness. And there was explosion branded beef product. Early 90s, it couldn't get anyone to put their names on it because they would tell us, we can't trust what's in the case. I'm not going to put my name on it, and therefore consumer be associated my name with a bad eating experience. We then offered guaranteed tender program, tremendous focus on food safety. Industry literally invested billions of dollars, and all of them have paid off a focus on food safety. From 1997 to 2003, there were some 2,100 new beef products were introduced. Okay? Now, the reason I say that is that as a country, we seem to have short memories on a lot of stuff. And I see a lot of implants and aggressive implants and that sort of stuff that I think there are a lot of influential folks that attend BIF and just beg you not to forget the lessons of the past. It would be pretty quick to lose it. As my good friend Dave was telling me, you know, it's hard to sell $5 a pound beef right now. Pork is going to be less than $1 a pound. So you got to give consumers what the reason they want it, but you got to give them what they want, and please don't forget the lessons of the past because we'll pay for it. Actually, I told my colleagues I'm going to propose this, and they kind of thought I was crazy, but I don't think it is. Food safety was a huge issue. 1993, we had an outbreak of E. coli 15787. No one was sharing information. 1997 or 1998, presidents of all beef packing plants got together and decided that food safety is a non-competitive issue. And the reason for that was if they decided not to eat beef, they couldn't care if it was JBS or Cargill or Tyson. They just would not eat beef. And the decision was made to share information to improve the food safety of beef as a whole. I think we should consider using a similar model for meat tenderness. With that, thanks, and I'm not sure, Robert, when we're going to answer questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you have any questions?
Absolutely. It's because of the there's a whole bunch of stuff. The red fiber has less calpains and a whole bunch of chemistry. But essentially, if you let the muscle go into full rigor, 48 hours to be sure, you don't need to age tenderloin.
So if
we
didn't stretch it with the
tenderloin, yes. In fact, you can do all age bone hanging, then tenderloin will be less tender because you don't you don't stretch it as much. Yes, sir. Yeah, near infrared.
So you're looking at wavelengths not sensible to the human.
Correct.
Not like people could use their eyes.
No, it's not color. Yes, sir. Yes, Robert.
I have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask. One of them is the advent and application
what technology?
Pre-rigger technologies like the steam and activating the washer.
Yes. For food safety stuff, yes.
Right. How do you feel that they impacted the standard issue if they did or didn't at all, and the cooling time that it takes to reduce the temperature in the kettle, how does that affect it, especially as it relates to something like drinking steel in the furnace?
Okay, those are rinse and chill and the stuff that and run of the mill kettle are different things. Rinse and chill is essentially a technology that you after the cattle slaughter you open the vein and you infuse it with a solution that goes uses the vascular system and then through diffusion it gets into the muscle, tenderizes the muscle. We did that kind of work and when I was at Michigan State. But that I don't know what's the effect on meat tenderness. It shouldn't have an effect because it has compound that tenderizes the meat. The vast majority of industry, the technology they use, like pre-evisceration washes, steam vacuum, and final washes, I doubt if they'll have any effect on meat tenderness because all that changes are very superficial. All of those are designed to remove or kill pathogens on the surface of the beef, just a very few millimeters. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Have you had any more look into the economy of that and what that might mean to carcasses that are not guaranteed tender? What kind of a discount price would you use?
See, I wouldn't give discount at all. It's just a creaming tool. I'll use this technology as a creaming tool to guarantee those to be tender. And, you know, there's tremendous market for commodity cattle. Sell those as commodity cattle, select choice, et cetera. And actually, we set the focus on select because it doesn't apply now because recently we've got select that was going for more than choice. Crazy world. Yes, Robert. But anyway, I would use it as a creaming tool, and I wouldn't say those are tough because it's not accurate to say tough because they are not tough. Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Trying to get me in trouble, Robert, aren't you? There are two vitamins essentially used, and one of them is vitamin E. I think that's usually used for color. And vitamin D is used for meat tenderness. And essentially, they use vitamin D to mobilize calcium from bone. And that calcium essentially is hypothesized that will elevate calcium concentration in the blood, and then it'll activate the calpain system. But I don't think that can happen. Because calcium is so vital to the life of the muscle, and it is so tightly regulated. The slightest changes in calcium concentration makes the muscle relax or make the muscle contract. So I don't believe that works. Vitamin D, in my assessment, will not work. If it works, if it gets you tenderization, the animal will be dead before you bring it to the kill floor. Exactly, exactly, on a dead cattle. Thank you.